This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this edition of the program, Crisis in Hong Kong. While the impact of the coronavirus pandemic continues to dominate international headlines, another geopolitical crisis is brewing. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. VOA Newsroom reports that China's parliament has approved this week a new national security law for Hong Kong that critics say threatens the city's semi-autonomous status. This law challenges the one country, two systems principle, which undergirds the basic law that has governed Hong Kong's special status since British rule ended in 1997. Analysts say it also has worrisome implications for U.S.-China relations, already strained over differences regarding the handling of the coronavirus pandemic and trade. The new law would prevent and punish acts of secession, subversion, or terrorism activities that are perceived to threaten Chinese national security. VOA News reports the law would also allow Beijing's national security organs to set up agencies in Hong Kong. The legislature's standing committee will begin drafting details of the law, which is expected to take effect in September. Business groups and many Western nations condemn the legislation, which they see as a death knell for Hong Kong's semi-autonomous status, especially because it bypassed Hong Kong's legislature. In June 2019, just 1 year ago, protests erupted in Hong Kong over the government's plans to allow some criminal suspects to be extradited to the Chinese mainland. Hong Kong officials withdrew that bill in September 2019, but street protests continued as demonstrators feared that Beijing was preparing to water down Hong Kong's democracy and autonomy nearly 30 years before the former British colony's special status expires. 1 year later, it turns out that those fears were well-founded. Beijing's announcement of the new national security law for Hong Kong sparked a new round of protests, similar to the massive and sometimes violent demonstrations that engulfed the city during the second half of 2019. VOA reports that as many as 360 people were arrested this past week to protest the national security bill. And VOA also reports that U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said he has reported to the U.S. Congress that Hong Kong no longer enjoys a high degree of autonomy from China. The secretary's remarks indicate that the United States is considering suspending the preferential status that has made the city a top U.S. trading partner. Regional observers are wondering what U.S. President Donald Trump will do now. Will he revoke Hong Kong's special trading status with the United States and risk plunging U.S.-China relations even deeper into crisis and hamper hopes for a new trade agreement? Or will the Trump administration focus on financial sanctions and visa restrictions on Chinese officials while holding back on tariffs, export controls, and investment restrictions until there's more clarity on the new Chinese law? David Lovinger, a former China specialist at the U.S. Treasury, told Bloomberg News that, quote, the Trump administration has to thread the needle of coming down on mainland and Hong Kong officials who support this while not being seen as attacking the Hong Kong people. Well, joining us to discuss the new crisis in Hong Kong are two distinguished regional analysts. Daniel Kleinman is a senior fellow and director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. That's a policy group based in Washington. And Dean Cheng, senior research fellow in the Asian Studies Center at the Heritage Foundation, a think tank also based in Washington. And both gentlemen join me via Skype as we continue social distancing. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having us.
You bet. Well, let me begin with you, Daniel Kleinman. How do you read this latest move by Beijing, and particularly the timing?
I think it's critical to keep in mind the context, which is we're seeing at the moment a dangerous combination of overconfidence in Beijing, certainly how it perceives kind of the international environment, that China's coming out of the coronavirus pandemic, seemingly rebounding ahead of other major economies, including the U.S., I think Xi Jinping feels like, despite suppressing information that ultimately helped the pandemic go global, that China's in a pretty good position right now compared to others, again, particularly Washington. So there's a great deal of, I would say, overconfidence in Beijing as it kind of looks at the international landscape, coupled with a deep-seated fear of kind of the domestic blowback related to coronavirus. Again, many people within China were, I think, deeply angered by the government's mishandling of COVID early on and the suppression of information. And so to me, the timing of this and trying to really once and for all kind of pull this thorn, as perceived by the Communist Party of China, which is Hong Kong, and put this legislation in play, it's very much driven by this kind of combination of both overconfidence and insecurity.
Dean Chang, driven by overconfidence, how do you see Beijing's move at this moment?
I'd almost flip that formula on its head. I think that when we look at how Beijing, basically in the last several weeks, has suddenly ratcheted up tensions all along its periphery, you could ascribe this to overconfidence, but I think that there is a much greater likelihood that what we are seeing is the old Chinese policy of when strong, feign weakness, but when weak, appear strong. So we see a number of things coming to a head all at the same time. We see a new outbreak of COVID-19 in China, where several million people, we think, may have been now put into lockdown in northeast China. Remember, Beijing claimed for a long time that it had the entire situation completely under control, with only 80,000 COVID-19 victims and perhaps 4,000 deaths in all of China. A nation roughly four times the size of the United States has a fraction of the casualties. If you believe that, for it to now suddenly break out and to have to lock down millions of people is not a good sign. We have the National People's Congress, for the first time, not setting any economic targets for economic growth in 2020/2021. That suggests that the economy is not looking good at all, and that the Chinese are going to have trouble coming out of it, which is not surprising because China, of course, continues to rely heavily on exports in a global marketplace that is still shut down due to COVID-19. So while all of this is going on, all of a sudden, the Chinese seem to be picking a fight along the Sino-Indian border, have suddenly ratcheted up pressure in the South China Sea. They've taken a black eye with regards to protective personal equipment, much of which they exported or sent out as aid, but found not to be working. I think that this may well be a Chinese effort on Hong Kong to send a message to both the foreign and domestic populations: don't push us. We have a lot of ability to crack down if you're not careful.
Back to you, Dan Kleiman. What does this law mean for Hong Kong?
So, Carol, I mean, U.S. policymakers have called it kind of the death knell of Hong Kong as a separate system within China. I don't think that's hyperbole. Again, I mean, we have yet to see the details as it's drafted, but all the information that's come out thus far suggests that it will allow Chinese domestic security forces to operate freely within Hong Kong, playing a similar role, which they have done within mainland China, which is often on very vague charges, whether it's treason, subversion, separatism, detaining, imprisoning, persecuting peaceful dissidents. So in my view, it very much makes one country, two systems an empty slogan going forward. I think for the people of Hong Kong, it probably is a testament to the fact that their protests were noted and that China now sees this as an opportunity to really crack down. But I think sadly, the kind of dark future, which many of the kind of pro-democracy activists in Hong Kong were predicting and really protesting to try to avoid, is coming at them and us collectively faster than all had anticipated.
Dean Chang, do you see it that way as well? Do you think that this national security law does pave the way for a death knell with respect to Hong Kong's special status under the one country, two systems concept?
I think it is probably the last nail or one of the last nails in the coffin. But if you look at the 2014 umbrella protests, the National People's Congress at that time went so far as to issue a white paper, which went to extraordinary lengths to explain that one country, two systems really meant one country took precedence over two systems, that two systems should never have been seen as somehow elevating Hong Kong to anything like equality. And what we have seen in the intervening 6 years is just a steady erosion of what was already being put on notice. So I don't think they're quite putting a toe tag on Hong Kong's political system, but I think that they are sort of looking at their watches and filling out the rest of the death certificate.
back to you, Dan Kleinmans. What about the role of the Legislative Council in Hong Kong and Carrie Lam, Hong Kong chief executive? Basically rubber stamp, they've been bypassed. What is your take?
Carol, I mean, it's clear the legislature has never been willing to pass this type of law. And that's the reason, despite often being seen as kind of a rubber stamp to mainland China. But ultimately, I mean, what we are seeing now is an effort by the Communist Party of China to bypass any of Hong Kong's kind of legislative organs, even though they are not completely independent by any means. And so to me, it is a sign that despite having a lot of influence and leverage over Carrie Lam and her administration, that even they were unable or unwilling to go so far as to kind of push this through themselves. So it is a sign of the what had been kind of the resiliency of Hong Kong's system. Fully agree with Dean that that system had been chipped away at steadily over the years. But I think seeing that now the Communist Party of China is essentially just bypassing what's left, I mean, to me, it shows that there was some resiliency, and even that is no longer tolerable for Beijing.
Back to you, Dean Cheng, with respect to the Legislative Council and Chief Executive Carrie Lam. I suppose they have no real say in these matters. Basically, this bill will allow China to use its national security agents in Hong Kong and define what terrorism is, which for them is anything that smacks of opposition to their way of governing, which is obviously autocratic and nothing to do with democracy.
Well, look at what was being debated in Hong Kong just last week, to the point where there were just about fistfights in their legislature, which is an effort to criminalize disrespect for the Chinese national anthem. This would seem a fairly simple law, but of course a violation of the concept of freedom of speech. And it got mired down in a lot of internal fighting, to the point of just about fistfights on the floor, showing that the legislature was not necessarily going to roll over, even though it was heavily stacked in favor of Beijing. What I do want to draw attention to, though, is Carrie Lam. You have to wonder, had she not introduced the whole extradition bill idea last year, would we now be where we are now? I think that that was a remarkably tone-deaf action. She did not seem to have thought through the consequences. You might wonder whether she came up with the idea in the first place or whether this was something pushed on her by Beijing. But I think that when the history of the end of Hong Kong is written, that set of decisions to proceed with a change to the extradition rules, which didn't seem to have any particular pressing need, seems to have basically lit the fuse that has now led to where we are.
That's a very good point. We'll have more in just a moment. But first, you're listening to Encounter on the Voice of America. My guests are Daniel Kleinmans, Senior Fellow and Director of the Asia-Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Dean Cheng, from whom you just heard. He's Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center. We're discussing Beijing's crackdown on Hong Kong by the implementation of a draconian national security law that threatens its semi-autonomous status. This is a reminder that our Encounter podcast is available on our website at voanews.com/encounter. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA. Here's a big shout out during these days of the pandemic to a loyal listener and Facebook fan, Olugbenga Ibiyemi, who writes to us from Loren, the capital of Kwara State in the mighty nation of Nigeria. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, as always, send us an email to encounter@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, back to our program and back to you, Daniel Kleinmans. And let's take a look at this topic from the protesters' point of view. Pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong, they're still braving the streets. What do the lead democracy activists want the United States and international community to do in light of this national security law?
I mean, Carol, I think first it's important to recognize the bravery of these protesters, particularly at a time when coronavirus is still something which many people are concerned about, to go on the streets to not only brave the Hong Kong police, but also potentially a pandemic as well, is quite remarkable. In terms of what the protesters want, and I would relate that to kind of what the United States should do. I think it's clear the protesters want pressure on China from the United States, from other democracies such as Europe. When you get more concrete than that, I think it becomes a little bit more complicated. And here I'll turn more to U.S. policy in that, I mean, the U.S. certainly has many levers it can pull, whether it is sanctioning individual, both mainland China officials, as well as potentially Hong Kong officials who are involved in essentially eliminating its separate status, to, of course, removing Hong Kong's kind of separate treatment under U.S. trade law and export control law. The challenge is that sanctions could potentially be targeted, but some of these larger policy levers will ultimately have large economic effects across Hong Kong. So potentially the protesters will experience some of the economic downturn as well. So for the U.S., it's a bit challenging. And you see U.S. officials making very careful statements about reviews and trying to determine the way forward, where at the end of the day, I mean, I think no one wants to have the kind of effects fall on the people of Hong Kong, vice the Communist Party of China and some of its enablers among the Hong Kong government. And so I think you'll see potentially some very kind of selective type sanctions. And I would see that being very much welcomed by protesters in Hong Kong. But some of the larger kind of economic levers, the U.S. may be a little slower to pull.
Dean Chang, I'm turning to you now for your take on the brave protesters, how they're still going out into the streets to protest this draconian law, even amid the coronavirus pandemic. What is your read on what they would like the United States in particular to do to try to thwart this law, slow it down, and talk also about the policy implications, if you like?
Well, I think, first off, anyone who remembers what happened in Tiananmen back in 1989 recognizes that the protesters in Hong Kong are running a risk. They are running a risk because they are opposing a government, not the Hong Kong government, obviously, but the Beijing government, that at the end of the day has a demonstrated willingness to call out overwhelming force and to employ that overwhelming, deadly, lethal force if necessary. So very clearly, the Hong Kong authorities have refrained from anything like that. And it is good news that the PLA garrison in Hong Kong has been, as far as we know, confined to quarters and has not been called out. But that could change. And one has to wonder whether this new national security law may, in fact, specifically vest military authorities or the security apparatus to call upon military forces if they deem it necessary. That would obviously be a further massive blow to Hong Kong. I think that the United States can do a number of things, and I think much of this would be consistent with what the Hong Kong people want. First and foremost is to keep drawing attention to this. One of the worst things to do is to ignore this, is to say, well, you know, nothing can be done. No one is going to go and invade Hong Kong to liberate it. So at the end of the day, it really is an internal Chinese affair. That is absolutely the message Beijing wants the world to accept. And it is absolutely the message that the Hong Kong people would find most devastating, to basically believe that they have been abandoned. Specific measures, I think that there is discussion about things like Global Magnitsky, especially if there is a crackdown. And again, invoking items like that may help stay some of the more extreme measures that may be under consideration in Beijing. The big issues, as Dan Kleiman noted, are going to be some of the economic levers, because they will have massive effects. They'll have massive effects not only on Hong Kong, but will directly affect U.S.-Chinese trade. If, for example, the U.S. basically says Hong Kong loses its special status and tariffs and things that have been applied to China trade are applied to Hong Kong. These are areas that really do need careful consideration. And it's pretty clear that while the U.S. has declared that Hong Kong is no longer autonomous, what that precisely means is probably still being worked out at the State Department, at Treasury, at Commerce, and frankly, at the Pentagon.
So back to you, Dan Kleiman. I don't think we can overestimate the seriousness of what is going on. You know, Hong Kong, they were supposed to have this special status at least until 2047. This is remarkable. And let's look again at the implications for the world, for not just the United States, but for democracy. I'd like to get your view on what specific policy levers you think the United States should deploy. What do you think the Trump administration is willing to do, especially when Secretary of State Pompeo says, you know, that they're considering suspending the preferential status that has made the city one of the top U.S. trading partners? You know, there's a lot at stake here.
Definitely. Maybe why don't I start with some of the kind of implications, and I'll turn to U.S. policy. I mean, there are a few implications. I think one, very much showcasing that all ultimately, the Communist Party of China cannot coexist with even a kind of a mini half democracy within its borders, very much showcasing the ideological nature of the Communist Party of China. I think certainly if you are sitting in Taiwan, I think this reinforces again the decision not to move closer to the mainland, and if anything, gives kind of further impetus to voices there that are pushing for more distance. Farther afield, this, I would say, is one part of a larger trend, which is Beijing breaking its promises. So whether it is to maintain Hong Kong's autonomy through 2047, whether it is to essentially dial down some of these territorial disputes it has with its neighbors, and Dean called out India, which is a great recent example, whether it is on trade to actually try to mitigate some of its mercantilist practices. So in my view, I mean, this, I think, reinforces for many democracies, ultimately, the regime in Beijing is not trustworthy. It can't uphold its promises and is very much driven by the need to kind of sustain its system, its authoritarian system at home. In terms of U.S. policy levers, my own view is that moving forward with targeted sanctions makes a good deal of sense. Potentially putting visa restrictions on whether it's mainland Chinese officials or Hong Kong officials who are essentially enabling further erosion of Hong Kong's economy makes sense as well. In terms of whether the U.S. should kind of terminate the economic special status for Hong Kong, I honestly would want to see more analysis of who that would affect and how before I would come down on it. Because, I mean, it's clear that would certainly have a lot of blowback on China, but it also would have some very severe repercussions for the people of Hong Kong, too.
Back to you, Dean Cheng. That's the key question, you know, how to, as we said earlier, thread this needle of coming down on Beijing and Hong Kong officials who support this draconian law while not deleteriously affecting the Hong Kong people. How do we thread this needle? If you were an advisor, let's say, to the Trump administration, this is a political year. President Trump originally was praising Xi Jinping for its handling of the coronavirus. Now, of course, he's saying the opposite. We have trade tensions. China is a big issue in the presidential campaign. And now we have this national security law.
Well, first off, I'm always a little troubled by this sort of, I think, false dichotomy of, well, we want to pressure officials, but we don't want to hurt the broader population. It's a laudable concept. The problem is, I'm not really sure how feasible that is. At some point, your policies are going to affect more than just a handful of people, or they are going to have no effect at all. But that being said, I think we should be thinking about some of the things that we can specifically do to help the people of Hong Kong. So one of the things to think about here is, given the likelihood of a significant crackdown by the Beijing authorities, would be to consider, for example, expanding the ranks of political refugee status. Do we want to give leading political dissidents in Hong Kong, leading pro-democracy activists, a potential backdoor, a way to get out of there should the Chinese start doing 3 a.m. no-knock raids on where they are living, where they are perhaps hiding? A second consideration here would be the Great Firewall of China. The Great Firewall of China is a key method by which China makes sure that information about places like Hong Kong are limited. So are there opportunities to expand, whether it is through programs like yours on the Voice of America, whether it is through cyber means, whether it is through other means of getting more information to the Chinese people? Not because I think they will necessarily sympathize with the people of Hong Kong. That's actually one of the bigger problems there. But at least to make them aware that this is an issue that is causing friction between the Chinese authorities and people abroad. I think a third aspect here is to push our friends and allies to make sure that they too keep Hong Kong, both the people and the political situation, in the public view. For example, if Vatican City were to withdraw its recognition of Taiwan right now or in the next few weeks or months, that would be a devastating blow to Hong Kong, because it would appear that the Vatican, the Catholic Church, doesn't particularly care about repression of the people of Hong Kong. Perhaps this would be a good time for the U.S. to recommend to the Vatican. Now would not be a good time to switch political recognition.
So they were planning to do that, Dean Cheng.
There has been a lot of discussion. There's been a lot of contact between the Catholic Church diplomats and the Chinese. The Chinese have been pushing very hard, making some very interesting offers to the Catholic Church about possibly having a little more autonomy. Interestingly, one thing that they have already leveraged out of the Vatican apparently was the names of at least some of the cardinals and bishops who had been held in secret. The Chinese have very clearly been pushing the Vatican for some kind of diplomatic exchange. The key thing being, of course, from China's perspective, that the Vatican would end its position as the last diplomatic outpost for Taiwan in Europe.
Well, General, and more implications than we have time to talk about with respect to China's crackdown on Hong Kong, but we will revisit this issue in the coming months. I'm afraid for now, that's all the time we have on this edition of Encounter. I'd like to thank my guests, Daniel Kleiman, Senior Fellow and Director of the Asia Pacific Security Program at the Center for a New American Security, and Dean Chang, Senior Research Fellow at the Heritage Foundation's Asian Studies Center.
Thank you again for having us.
Thank you for having us.
Encounter was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. I'm Carol Castiel. Do join me again next week for another Encounter on the Voice of America.